Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Intelligence Matters ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
What would the world look like if China achieves its ambitions, and how would that be different from the way it looks today?
Well, I think it looks like a 19th century world, a world that is sort of pre-international norms and rules in which states can exercise, you know, their policies and their desires with a degree of freedom that really, you know, allows that power is essentially the only thing that is a determinant of whether they're able to do it or not.
Matt Turpin is a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution, specializing in U.S. policy towards China, economic statecraft, and technology innovation. He is also a senior advisor at Palantir Technologies. From 2018 to 2019, Matt served as the U.S. National Security Council's Director for China and as the Senior Advisor on China to the Secretary of Commerce. Before entering the White House, Matt served over 22 years in the U.S. Army in a variety of positions, including serving as an advisor on China to the Chairman and Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I just sat down with Matt to talk about his career and about China. We'll be right back with that discussion after a word from our sponsor, Lockheed Martin. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well, inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Matt, I want to start by asking you a bit about your career. You attended and graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. I want to ask you, how did you end up there? What attracted you about serving in the military?
Yeah, that's sort of a way back machine kind of question.
Yeah.
I entered West Point in 1991. And obviously we had sort of just, the summer of 1991. So we had just fought the Gulf War. I had been kind of interested in the military. My dad is a college professor. Yeah, I'd had grandfathers in the military and an aunt and uncle, but I had no real experience. But it seemed like something exciting. It seemed like something that I could kind of belong to. And as a high school student coming out of Southern California, amazingly, there were not a whole bunch of people that wanted to go to upstate New York to go to school. So my ability to get into to West Point was much easier than my ability to get into the Naval Academy or the Air Force Academy. It just sort of turned out that way. But it was something that I was interested in, but really didn't have any idea of what it was like. I'd never been to West Point before. I showed up the day before reception day, mm-hmm. And drove in on a bus from like Newark, New Jersey. The entire bus was silent as everyone was realizing that this was sort of the end for, quite a while.
Right.
And we'd be getting off and getting yelled at and harassed. And it turned out to be exactly that way for a couple of years. So, yeah.
And then where did your interest in China come from?
Oh, well, I did not actually spend any of my academic career, whether it was as an undergrad or at graduate school. I actually have a graduate degree in American history from UNC Chapel Hill. And it wasn't really until about, a little over a decade ago, as I took an assignment, where I got to choose between an assignment, being a liaison officer at the Pentagon for CENTCOM, right? So focused on the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
or I could go be a war planner out in Honolulu at Pacific Command. And that was a pretty easy choice, all things considered. And so that was 2010. And obviously that was sort of the beginning of a pivot, or a rebalance to Asia. And so I got sort of a front row seat as sort of the U.S. policy community began to pivot and rebalance towards the challenges that we saw in Asia. And so have been kind of doing that for, I guess a little over a decade now. But that's how I got into it. It wasn't necessarily that I had sort of a long career as, I wouldn't necessarily be called a classic China hand. I was much more interested in U.S. policy, sort of what our national security and foreign policy interests were. It just happened to be that Beijing was beginning to pose some of the most important challenges, which was what pushed me into that area.
So what did you learn about China in that job at Pacific Command? How did that shape your views?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it gave me a pretty intense understanding of our military challenge, as well as a view of how our allies and partners viewed the U.S. position. This was a period of time. So this was sort of, near the beginning of the Obama administration. There was clear efforts by the administration to begin to sort of rebalance what it was focused on. And I got to sort of see that up close, from a headquarters that was looking at it every day.
Right.
One of the most important things that sort of, one of the most sort of, influential things on my thinking was the whole experience around, the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear accident in Japan in March of 2011, and where we had been with the Japanese government and the U.S. government in sort of our relations up until that point, there had been some drifting, and it was increasingly difficult to see how the U.S. and Japan would continue to operate as an alliance. That experience really sort of reset the U.S.-Japanese relationship, and then that came on the heels of a number of things that was happening to Japan, and really a real appreciation of what the U.S.'s role and how it would interact with its allies, and got to watch that up close with some really impressive leaders at Pacific Command. As well as our folks on the ground in Japan, that the U.S. and Japan could work together, and could sort of re-cement its alliance and begin to deal with sort of an increasingly aggressive, and assertive Beijing that was sort of stressing that international system. That period of time, sort of 2011 to 2012 was quite instrumental in at least in my thinking. And made me realize this is something that we needed to spend much more time on. And it's what I decided to then sort of, not necessarily return to the regular army, but take a job back in the Pentagon, sort of running China strategy in the joint staff for what ended up being 4 years working for General Dempsey and then General Dunford, Admiral Winnefeld and General Selva, as well as Deputy Secretary Work, which was very much instrumental in my kind of thinking about what the challenges were and how the United States would have to begin to respond.
And in what way?
So I mean, this period, you know, by early 2013, you have Xi Jinping coming to power, and you have, you know, sort of two modes of thought inside the U.S. government sort of forming. One that sort of our strategy that had been in place for really about two and a half decades, you know, a strategy of using economic engagement to drive political liberalization. It was becoming sort of frayed that strategy was not necessarily resulting in the outcomes that we had expected, right? We were certainly seeing some spectacular economic progress inside the PRC. And so, you know, from that sense, you know, our intention to help the Chinese economy develop seemed to be working quite well. But the other half of it, which is that we would then expect to see political liberalization, right? Greater freedoms, greater transparency, you know, a strengthening of the rule of law, you know, sort of a division of powers. Clearly, as Xi Jinping came in and sort of re-cemented the position of the party, it became increasingly hard to see how that strategy of economic engagement was resulting in the outcomes that what we wanted to see, and that we needed to sort of wrestle with the implications of a change in our strategy, right? And that, you know, that transition point, and that transition point kind of happened between, you know, sort of late 2013, and then, you know, certainly by the end of the Obama administration, a realization that we were likely going to have to pursue a different course, and adopt a new strategy to secure U.S. interests and to protect, you know, the interests of our allies.
Matt, then you go to the White House as the director for China on the staff of the National Security Council and as an advisor on China to the Secretary of Commerce. Let me ask you two questions, real quick questions. One, sure. were you still in the military at that point, or had you retired?
I retired the summer of 2017 and then interviewed with Secretary Ross during my time in terminal leave from the military. Terminal leave is sort of the last leave you take in the military. It sounds worse than it is. And then I took the job at the White House and with the Commerce Department in January of 2018. So I had about a 6-month window from leaving the military and then, you know, coming back in as an appointee.
And then did you do both of those jobs at once, the Commerce job and the NSC job, or did one transition into the other?
So the Commerce job, I was hired to take that job to then be a detailee to the White House. So that those were simultaneous. Got to know the team at Commerce, you know, an absolutely critical department that probably doesn't get nearly the attention or, you know, sort of interest from the national security community. So I felt, you know, absolutely critical to sort of be there and felt myself quite lucky to work in that department, but spent, you know, was on detail to the National Security Council for my entire time, other than sort of 2 weeks on either end.
And this period of time is really the beginning of the shaping of a new U.S. approach to China, right? We had gone through that realization that you talked about, right, from 2010 to 2014, 15, 16, and this was the beginning of a new approach. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, that new approach, you know, certainly became, you know, the outlines of it. You could see in a series of speeches and documents that, you know, at the time, I remember Deputy Secretary of Defense Work, Bob Work, you know, making, you know, going out and engaging with our European allies to talk about the kinds of things that both China and Russia were doing. You'll remember, you know, obviously, at the same time, you've got, you know, realization that our approach towards Moscow also was not resulting in the kinds of outcomes that we had wanted. And so you sort of had these dual challenges, you know, both Moscow and Beijing coming up at the same time, and that there would need to be sort of a new approach. And so, you know, part of this, you know, certainly the language of competition, you know, certainly the summer of 2016, you've got folks like, you know, Secretary Carter, you know, testifying along with General Dunford, you know, about a need for sort of viewing our relationship with both Moscow and Beijing as competitive. And then, you know, the Trump administration comes in early January 2017, and begins really a policy process, you know, largely led by General McMaster, who then leads the sort of the National Security Council, you know, through a policy process that arrives at a national security strategy that lays out, you know, strategic competition with both Moscow and Beijing are sort of our principal focuses. You know, and that's published in December of 2018 or 2017. But you'll remember that you know, for instance, the Section 301 investigation, which was really an investigation of China's sort of economic behavior, begins in August of 17. And you can see that you know, there's an effort to sort of create a holistic approach, both an economic policy and a national security policy that are combined in a way to be able to begin to compete with the PRC. And for too long, we had sort of viewed those two elements of our policy, both an economic policy and a national security policy, as sort of separate things existing in separate worlds.
Right.
And really an effort to bring those things together in terms of shorthand. This is sort of, you know, that economic security is national security. And so you have a number of these sort of, you know, sayings that are sort of going out there, but it's really reflecting sort of a wrestling with the idea that ultimately, in a world in which you've got other great powers that are using sort of all means at their disposal, and particularly in sort of the economic, commercial, and financial spaces to compete with us, that you know, untying our hand from behind our back and beginning to sort of use various sort of economic tools was something that we would have to consider, you know, much more strongly. And so, you know, to me, there's a lot of continuity here from the kinds of things that you had folks in the Department of Defense, as well as Penny Pritzker at the Commerce Department of the Obama administration, in which they're looking at sort of Chinese industrial policies, how they harm the United States, how they sort of undermine, you know, elements of our national security and our allies, and that we would begin to have to wrestle with what do we do in response to this. And that, you know, in true sort of Washington fashion, you know, that's a messy debate that unfolds over time. But because we can discuss these things sort of out in the open, at a certain point in time, you begin to have sort of a degree of consensus forming that ultimately we're in a different position than we had been, you know, a decade before with Beijing.
So, Matt, I want to switch to China directly, if that's okay. And I want to ask you two questions. And to be honest, the second of which I have a hard time finding someone to answer with the kind of precision that I think is necessary to kind of bring the country along with us here. The first question is, can you describe the world order that China would like to see? In other words, what would the world look like if China achieves its ambitions, and how would that be different from the way it looks today?
Yeah. Well, I think it looks like a 19th century world in which, you know, a world that is sort of pre-international norms and rules, in which states can exercise, you know, their policies and their desires with a degree of freedom that really, you know, allows that power is essentially the only thing that is a determinant of whether they're able to do it or not. You know, certainly Beijing has benefited, you know, economically over the past sort of four decades from a stable international order that allows them to grow as an economic power. And as a wider sort of national power. But I also believe it's quite clear that they view those conditions as constraints on Beijing achieving sort of, you know, what the party lays out for itself, and certainly what Xi Jinping both, you know, and I think, you know, the amazing continuity between the speech he gave as an inaugural speech in January of 2013 to the Central Committee as he took power, and the one that he gave last week on the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party, you know, viewing himself as you know, viewing the party and the Chinese nation as in a sort of historical struggle to remake the international system to secure what Beijing thinks and particularly the party thinks is the appropriate ways for their governance to run, and that would look very different than an idea of rule of law, of sort of separations of power, of transparency, and that while I don't think that Beijing seeks to install the, you know, a clone of the Chinese Communist Party in every country around the world, it doesn't want a system that confines or undermines the Beijing's ability to achieve what it wants to do. So it's much more for them about themselves, and that the rest of the world needs to get out of the way, as opposed to making the rest of the world look like them.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. Then we'll be right back with more of a discussion with Matt Turpin.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
Matt, a couple of kind of sub-questions to that first one. What does Beijing want to use its unconstrained power for? Is it to sustain their economy and sustain the party? Is it for other reasons? That power that they want to use in that unconstrained way, what's the bottom line for them? What's the objective?
Yeah. I mean, there is, I think there is a sort of a wide debate, right? You know, and some of the debate within sort of the community of China watchers and those that are looking at it, you know, one side of it, I think, sees that simply China simply wants to realize sort of a peer status in the world and then sort of take its place within an international system and then make sort of minor changes around the edges of that international system. I think that's a wishful idea. That certainly is an idea that we in both the United States and probably our friends in Europe and in Japan, you know, could reconcile with. We could reconcile if that was the extent
right
of Beijing's desires. I'm increasingly concerned, and I think, you know, there are plenty of others that watch as well, that Beijing actually has a much broader set of intentions, that the PRC views itself, you know, in the broad national rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, and that the PRC's rightful place is at sort of the center of the global order, and that until the global order is nearly completely reordered around the party's intentions, that it won't be enough, and that there are many things that they view in sort of a nationalist sense as, you know, crimes against the Chinese nation that took place, you know, in the 19th and 20th centuries that would need to be rectified, and that you know, those are certainly around borders, and are about sort of reestablishing the PRC's place in the world. And so I think that's sort of a nationalist angle of it. But I think there is also sort of deep party ideology. There's a tendency for us to think that the Chinese Communist Party is not communist, and that they don't actually believe any of the ideology, you know, that comes from a Marxism, Leninism, and Stalinist background, right? About party organization, and about how the party should rule, and its mission in essentially achieving, you know, broad social revolution. And I think to a certain degree, you know, that's again also wishful thinking on our part. It's really convenient for us to sort of want to think that, you know, so the communism of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is has been relegated to the dustbin of history, and that our friends in Beijing have learned that that's not the way to go. But increasingly, it appears that language and that ideology infuses much of what the party says to itself. And I tend to think, and as a historian, I tend to think that folks, you know, when they make speeches and write papers and continuously harp on things, right, that they're in a long-term struggle between, you know, socialism and capitalism, that they actually believe some of those things, that those terms and that language is not simply thrown out as fluff on the side of a broader speech, but are actually the centerpiece of what the party believes, and certainly Xi Jinping believes, right? That they believe that there is a broad ideological struggle going on about, you know, different forms of governance and testing of which system is better. And so for the United States, if we're interested in maintaining an international system which privileges democracies, which privileges the rule of law and privileges individual rights, then we likely have to stand up for that. Yeah. It isn't going to happen on its own. And the PRC would prefer a world where those values are not privileged, and that what you see is actually the privileging of an aristocracy, a red aristocracy inside the PRC, you know, privileging the idea that the state controls outcomes and does so for the benefit of the ruling regime as opposed to its individual citizens, and that sort of many of the things that we would want to see is further progress in from a U.S. perspective, and for other democracies would be very difficult in a kind of world that was reordered around what Beijing has in mind.
So, Matt, you mentioned Xi's speech last week at the 100th anniversary of the founding of the party. And one of the things that I found interesting about the speech, and I'd love to get your reaction to this, is it didn't sound like the country that was ready to take its place at the center of things, right? It sounded to me like there was a lot of insecurity in the speech. And I'm wondering if you sense the same thing, and if so, why that tone? Do they really feel like they're not quite there yet? To what extent are they worried about us? Where do you think that tone came from?
Well, I mean, that tone did not arise last week,
right?
You know, there's this. I think, you know, longstanding paradox. You know, within the Chinese Communist Party, but ultimately within other sort of authoritarian, sort of Leninist model parties, in which sort of, you know, a relatively small band of elites, you know, seeks to claim exclusive rule that can't be challenged. And that part of the ways that they legitimize that rule is by trying to assure their population that any potential benefit that they might want, that they have gained, or what they want in the future, can only come through the stabilizing force of that aristocracy, and that without them, that the country would fall into chaos and that everything would be disastrous. And I think that for the Chinese Communist Party, you know, that is a sort of a well-ingrained concept, right? You know, deeply, deeply established. But I think that that they have to continuously struggle with the fact that there are just a lot of places in the world where ruling parties get voted out of power and the entire society doesn't collapse. And it suggests that maybe that entire sort of ideology that they must be allowed to continue to rule no matter what. And that if they don't rule, that complete disaster faces the nation. You know, it's without a significant effort to continuously sort of stress that propaganda position, right? That
gotcha.
That assertion, that folks begin to ask questions about, is that really true?
Yeah. Right?
And so, you know, I think, you know, that is one of the underlying things. It's almost as if it's a shrill sort of language of, you know, we are unstoppable, and, you know, our legitimacy and rule is completely unquestionable. You know, the lady doth protest too much.
Yeah. We're going to take another quick break. We'll be right back with more Intelligence Matters. I'm Michael Morrell.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
So, Matt, this second question I wanted to ask you is, what are the specific downsides to us, to the United States and China achieving the world that they're trying to create? You know, would our standard of living be lower than it otherwise would be? Would our privacy and civil liberties be put at risk? Would the world be a less stable place, et cetera, et cetera? You know, in other words, how to explain to somebody in the United States why we should see China as such a significant challenge and to treat it as such?
Yeah. I mean, we could sort of take any number of these sort of angles, but, you know, maybe I'll start with sort of the economic side. And you know, I mean, there was a thesis broadly held across sort of you know, policy communities that by allowing China into the WTO, even though it had not become a market economy, right? So even though that it didn't essentially have, you know, didn't follow ideas of free markets and hadn't implemented the policies that would have the states step out of control of economic policy, or step out, you know, of control of how prices were determined and things like that, which was the standard that we had set for nearly every other country to join the WTO. That there had been this theory that through comparative advantages and everything else, that we would find ourselves, you know, in a significantly better position, and we would have resulted in sort of political liberalization within the PRC. Well, we didn't get the second, but increasingly it was clear, and you know, I certainly, you know, by early 2016, you have a number of economists writing about the China shock, right?
Right.
So the implications of what China's entry into the WTO, their failure to fulfill their commitments to the entry into the WTO, right? So they, you know, they were not a market economy yet, but they essentially had made commitments that they would become a market economy. They would continue liberalization reforms, but those liberalization reforms, you know, really began to taper off significantly as China entered the WTO, and certainly the Chinese state never stepped away from an idea that they would be the ultimate arbiter of how the economy ran. And while we saw a blossoming of private enterprise, you know, we also saw, you know, continued intervention and subsidization, which then undermined, you know, U.S. manufacturing and undermined a number of parts of the U.S. economy. And I think it was the announcement of China's policy of Made in China 2025, you know, in 2015, which essentially laid out that what China had done to low-value manufacturing, right, textiles and, you know, simple electronics and, you know, and various industrials, and that they would take those same tactics and apply them to high value manufacturing, which for the United States, for Japan, for Korea, for our European friends, you know, these were the, this was the lifeblood of our economic prosperity, and that the PRC would begin to apply those same tactics to be able to gain, you know, national champions and execute the same sort of playbook on high value manufacturing, which really sits at the centerpiece of U.S. economic prosperity. And that if that were to play out, that it would be extremely damaging to our own prosperity. And so, you know, what we had seen happen across the Rust Belt, where sort of U.S. manufacturing was carved out as you move to lower, you know, lower cost labor inside the PRC, you know, a period of what was called globalization, but I think, you know, is really much more accurately to be seen as hyper concentration of manufacturing on the East Coast of China, that created real impacts inside the United States in terms of economic prosperity. And certainly there are claims that consumers can purchase things for less money, but if you're not making a paycheck, you know, slightly less cost is really not all that much of a balm to that broader problem of sort of losing your livelihood.
Right.
And so I think, you know, that is what we sort of saw kind of going forward from an economic perspective, if Beijing achieves what, you know, it is laying out that it wants to be able to do. You know, we could kind of go on to what, like, sort of what the world would look like. But you know, I think our one aspect of it is that you will be very much limited into sort of what you can say and think. So if you touch on things that the party does not find, you know, that the party objects to, that there will be sort of extraterritorial reach of how your thoughts are regulated, what you can see on the internet, what you can be allowed to say. We've seen American citizens, you know, inside the United States, you know, be coerced and retaliated against for things that, you know, they would say online, and that would generally find itself established across the world, and we would find ourselves in just a very much less free area, and that countries would feel obliged to limit the speech and protests of their own citizens in order to stay on the right side of Beijing. And yeah. And to me, that's a very disturbing world to find ourselves in.
So Matt, what will determine who wins this competition, who wins this struggle for what the world is going to look like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one, I'd say that, you know, I've often compared us as just sort of being like in a, you know, in an endless relay race, and that each of us sort of has sort of a race to run, but there isn't necessarily a clear finish line.
Yeah.
You know, it is a matter of making ourselves better. And certainly I think the Biden administration, you know, has come out very strong in laying out its case about, you know, in a long-term competition with authoritarian states, you know, like the one that is represented by the Chinese Communist Party, that we need to make ourselves better. And so that's, I think, a critical component of it. And I'm optimistic to see the kinds of things that are being sort of put forward to be able to realize that. You know, but obviously that isn't the only thing that you've got to be able to do. I mean, you also want to make sure that it's more costly for your competitor to achieve their objectives. And that requires so both a combination of carrots and sticks to help you achieve your objectives and undermine your competitor from achieving their objectives. And that, you know, that may sit sort of wrong with some folks who would think that, you know, what we should be striving for is full-on cooperation. You know, I wish that were the world we lived in, but it would appear, you know, very clearly to me that is not the sort of approach that Beijing wants. They would want us to cooperate with their objectives while they compete strenuously to achieve their own objectives and undermine ours. And that's just sort of the world that we live in. And so I think that's kind of what we've got right now. And so maybe I'll stop there.
So how do you think this ends? There is no finish line, of course, but are you optimistic or are you pessimistic about our ability to compete with this country and its vision of the world?
Well, I'm very optimistic. I mean,
yeah, you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah. I mean, I think we should be very confident in our ability to compete over the long term. You know, we need to understand sort of what the stakes are, but I mean, Americans and our friends around the world who also enjoy this international system, you know, as we are motivated to be able to protect what we value, I think that we have enormous advantages. And I think, you know, what you brought up earlier about sort of the tone inside Xi Jinping's speech last week, as well as the tone that we've seen, whether it's through Wolf Warrior diplomacy or various other areas, it suggests a real deep concern inside the Communist Party about their ability over time to be able to do this. And so I think we should be confident, but that does not mean that it will be easy.
Right.
We will have to make sacrifices and invest significant resources to be able to do this over time. But I think the kind of world we want in the future is worth those investments. And we shouldn't shy away from them. We should also be very open and discuss it amongst ourselves, right? It is not as if all of these things are over and the debate is over and that we just have to resign ourselves to a long-term competition. I welcome that we have a long-term debate about this and that we continuously have the discussion out there, because obviously Beijing could choose another direction. And if they chose to do so, we should welcome that, right? If they chose to essentially say, you know, these are things that, you know, there are things that we're going to align with the United States and other democracies on reinforcing, we should be ready to accept that, but cautious of their intentions, but absolutely ready to embrace it should they choose to do so.
But really make the investments we need to make here at home and push back on them and make their life more difficult if they go in the wrong direction.
Right. And I think we also need to be aware that tactic, right, that strategy that you just described, I think, very well, will elicit from Beijing the ideas that will lead to sort of inevitable conflict and that we should abandon that strategy. And I think that's also a degree of, shows their real concern.
Yeah.
Because that approach, right, do our own thing better and compete with them vigorously and build sort of alliances to be able to make that happen, is what scares Beijing, right? And one of the things they will seek to do to sort of take us off that game is to try to convince us that by pushing back against them, it will lead to conflict and war and catastrophe. And I think we should remain mindful of that, but we should not let that kind of language deter us from doing the kinds of things that we probably know are right to do.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great discussion, and we hope to have you back again sometime.
Well, thank you, Michael.
That was Matt Turpin. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ashley Armstrong. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
Catch every episode of 60 Minutes, America's most watched news magazine show, as a podcast. Hear in-depth investigations across politics, news, and entertainment on your schedule. Listen to 60 Minutes ad-free on Wondery Plus.